You're listening to NPR on Health. I'm your host, Joe Neal. In this week's podcast, I have quite a mix of stories for you. The first is about a phenomenon called exergaming. That's where video game makers are trying to create programs to give you a good workout. Then we'll hear about two studies that came out recently. One is about whether women should be getting an ultrasound test in addition to their regular mammogram. The next looks at an issue that many people have wondered about. Do children who are adopted in infancy end up having more emotional problems when they're adults? Then we'll hear from a disaster relief expert on the health risks that follow a natural disaster like the cyclone in Myanmar or the earthquake in China. And finally, we'll hear from one prominent scientist who has decided to stop taking money from drug companies. In our first report, NPR's Allison Aubrey serves as both reporter and coach. When we got word the other day that there was a new presidential fitness test for adults, she went out and recruited a couple of staff members to take the test, and we'll hear about that in a moment. But first, Allison's going to tell us about a gaming conference she went to recently, where the new Wii was on display, and several other games that are part of this new phenomenon called exergaming. Here's her report.
There's been a lot of chatter that the Nintendo Wii motivates families to get up and move around. Next week, Nintendo releases in the U.S. an even more active set of games called Wii Fit. One of the games is a hula hoop challenge.
Very good. He looks ready. His shoes are off.
The first player hops on the Wii balance board, where the game can sense all of his movements. We're in a packed demonstration hall at the Baltimore Convention Center. The player is Alistair Thin. He's a Scottish exercise physiologist attending the convention.
You know, I know what exercise is. I can measure exercise on a bike or a treadmill.
But getting your heart rate up with a hula hoop game? Well, let's find out. Julia Lofgren of Gaming for Health revs up the excitement with her play-by-play of the virtual characters.
Now watch this. People are throwing hula hoops at him as he's hula hooping, and he has to capture them on his head. There he goes. Will he catch it? I understand if you put out your arms, it helps.
As he ducks and dives, Alistair Thin's performance begins to attract a crowd.
How many hula hoops can he wear? He's up to three. He's keeping three in motion.
When Thin hops off the board a few minutes later, he puts his finger to his wrist to take his pulse.
156.
So your heart rate's 156.
That's hard exercise.
So tell me, how do you feel?
Yeah, a little bit breathless. Yeah, we're cooling down again now.
All right, you started off with a dress shirt on, now you're down to a t-shirt.
Yeah. I'm not used to this hot weather.
Alistair Thin has a funny name for an exercise physiologist. He teaches in the much cooler climate of Edinburgh, Scotland. For his students, the weather can be an obstacle to outdoor exercise, at least part of the year. So when Wii Fit first hit store shelves in Great Britain last month, Thin was ready in his exercise lab to test it out. He bought two game consoles and recruited 11 students to try a bunch of games. Each of them wore a heart rate band so he could get measurements on how much of a workout they were really getting, and he made a video recording, starting with the Wii Step Aerobics game.
You can see, a bit like Dance Dance Revolution, that the moves are being up on the screen there.
But Thin says students had a little trouble following the game, so their heart rates rose to the equivalent of a moderate walking pace. By comparison, he says 6 minutes of hula hooping got the students to the cusp of a moderately intense cardiovascular workout.
The whole thing is, it's not just your hips, it's your arms, your shoulders, your legs, your ankles, everything's working there, and you're exercising really pretty hard.
The point of exergaming is that it's supposed to be more appealing than just walking or running on a treadmill. And when Thin surveyed his students, they did report that it was fun. What's unclear is whether they would have had the same experience without other students playing along. Was it the camaraderie or the competition that kept them going? These are the questions Thin wants to answer with additional research.
Well, that's why I think it's very important to get sort of good measurements as to just how much physical activities involved.
Convincing studies could help push virtual gaming into more public spaces, such as schools, gyms, and rec centers. A company called Exergame Technology is already moving in that direction. At the conference, salesman David Monk demonstrates a throwing game with their interactive sport wall. It looks like a 12-foot electronic whack-a-mole game.
Sky's the limit in what you can do with this. Each panel can handle 10 to 12 kids in a relay-style game, and it doesn't take up any space. It only sticks out about 4.5 inches off the wall.
To demonstrate, Cameron Goldstein and his brother toss bean bags at different light-up targets.
The target moves around, and the point is to get where the target is.
The boys are clearly engaged and having fun, but the question is, why do kids need all the lights and action? What's wrong with good old-fashioned play? I put the question to Brian Batiste. He runs a company called Lightspace, which makes a virtual dodgeball game. For starters, he says it's safer.
I guess nobody gets hit in the face with a ball with this game. You know, they get hit in the foot with it by a piece of light, right? So anything that's going to get kids off the couch, so to speak, it's going to be huge.
So given the number of games demonstrated at the convention, it's clear that kids have a lot of options. But what about adults? Well, just this week, the President's Council on Physical Fitness put up a new program on the internet. It tests physical fitness, and it gives a baseline for designing an exercise program. So when I got back to the office, I asked my two middle-aged colleagues to try it, David Malikoff and John Hamilton.
I'm 47 years old.
And David?
I'm 46.
Okay, so you guys are about the same age, and I know you're both competitive, so here's the deal. There's going to be 4 activities, sit-ups, push-ups, stretching, and we're going to put you on the scale to test your body mass index. Now, first, you're going to have to do a cardiovascular test.
All right, so the goal is to walk a mile, and at the end, we have to measure our heart rate. Whoever has the lower heart rate is the winner. Ready, set, go.
Doing all right there? I'm breathing a little bit. Just a little bit, though. Just a little bit.
All right, here we go.
All right.
Through the finish line.
Hey, finished. All right. Now it's time for a little pulse taking.
All right.
All right, so guys, how'd it go?
Well, it appears that I had a slightly lower heart rate at the end of our 1 mile walk than John did.
Assuming he was counting accurately.
What I'm picking up, what I'm detecting in your voice is maybe a little competition going on here?
Oh, we're not competitive. We're friends.
John is an outstanding young man.
All right, we got to move on. Richard Harris, come along with us. We need you to judge the push-ups.
Okay.
All right,
you ready?
Are you ready for this?
I'm
sure.
Good. I'm
you're
good.
Okay,
I'm
you're
feeling good.
All right,
okay.
Feeling strong.
All right,
two,
all right.
Four, three, five, six, seven.
I give up.
Eight, I'm done, man.
I don't think I'm fit enough to take the president's fitness test.
So it looks like we've got a clear winner here. David did 15, John did 30. Right. Guys, we're going to head down to the NPR fitness room, down in the basement of the NPR headquarters. We're going to do the last leg of the competition down here, the curls or the sit-ups. Okay, Brenda Wilson, will you watch David?
Gentlemen, are you ready?
Ready.
Keep your back down, 4. Keep your back down, 5. Keep your back down, 6.
42. Time! 42 over here.
Okay, John had a wild-eyed look over here, but I think he did nearly double as many.
That's hard.
Okay, after this, guys, you're done with movement. So this is the sit and reach test. It's designed to measure your flexibility. Okay, it says with your fingertips in contact with the yardstick.
David Malikoff and John Hamilton, come down to the mailroom. I've found a scale.
All right, so we are completely naked here in the mailroom.
Do take your shoes off, then we know it's
all right,
body
all right.
Weight.
Shoes off. Shoes off, clothes on. All right, I am stepping on to the scale.
Okay, it's hovering at 15999, so we're going to put you 160. All right, David, hop on there.
Well, let's see. In high school, I weighed 155, so I think I'm probably right around there still.
All right, let's see. It's hovering around, 195. All right, David, 195.
All right, let's enter the data, man.
Yeah, we're sitting in front of the computer. We've got the website up. Now we need to input all the numbers. Okay, so I've got the results in front of me. John, it looks like you were in the 81st percentile.
I feel okay about that.
And David, it looks like you were in the 51st percentile, right about dead in the middle.
Yeah, but I learned I'm a little overweight and got some work to do.
There's always next year, right?
Man, I'm coming back. I'm ready. Watch out for me next year.
I'll be here, man.
That was NPR's Allison Aubrey, of course, with test takers David Malikoff and John Hamilton. She had help from Brenda Wilson and Rebecca Davis. All from NPR's Science Desk. Mammography is a very accurate way to diagnose breast cancer, but it doesn't pick up every tumor. So researchers for many years have been looking at whether ultrasound or other tests might improve the accuracy of mammograms. Now a new study that came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association shows that women who are at a particularly high risk of breast cancer, women who've had a relative who was diagnosed with breast cancer before age 50, these women should probably have an ultrasound test in addition to their regular mammogram. NPR's Patty Namond explains.
Dr. Wendy Berg is a radiologist at Johns Hopkins University. She was interested in finding out whether ultrasound could pick up cancers mammography could not. Earlier studies had suggested this. Berg enrolled over 2,000 women at 21 different imaging centers across the U.S. These were women with the kind of breast tissue that can be challenging to find cancer using mammograms alone. The tissue is dense and it shows up as white on a mammogram, the same color, says Berg, as cancer.
Ultrasound is a completely different way of looking at the breast tissue that is not at all limited by how dense the breast tissue is. It's just using sound waves to penetrate the breast tissue. And we see cancers because they're darker usually than the tissue around them.
So in this study, ultrasound, in addition to mammography, picked up 28% more cancers than mammography alone. That's a lot, says Berg.
And the types of cancer that we see with ultrasound are still small, but they are invasive cancers. They're the type that spread when they are not detected. And in this study, we found that the vast majority of cancers we found with ultrasound had not yet spread to lymph nodes. And that's important. Those are the types of cancers that we need to be finding.
Berg says these are cancers that could eventually show up as a lump in the breast, cancers that might also spread to lymph nodes. While these findings are important, Berg says there are some cautions. The ultrasound was 4 times more likely than the mammogram to find lesions or abnormalities that looked like cancer but were not.
That's a fairly substantial risk of an unnecessary biopsy. Now, for some women, they would still want to have the test because it certainly has a chance of finding cancer when it's still early and treatable. But for other women, that's too great a risk of a false positive, and they don't want to take that chance.
Biopsies, of course, are a surgery, which require anesthesia and carry some risk. Dr. Lawrence Bassett heads the UCLA Iris Cantor Center for Breast Imaging. Bassett says ultrasound should not be done routinely for all women. It should be done for women at high risk of breast cancer, those who have dense breast tissue or have a close relative who was diagnosed with breast cancer before the age of 50. And if women are at even higher risk, for example, they or one of their close relatives carry the breast cancer gene, then, says Bassett, an MRI is recommended.
And I mean women who have genetic changes or they've had previous biopsies that show very lesions that tend to put you at higher risk. They may have had breast cancer before and have a strong family history as well.
For these very high-risk women, Bassett says MRI can pick up more cancer by detecting areas of particularly high blood flow, which tumors need to grow. In an editorial published along with this study, researchers suggest the future of breast cancer screening will likely become far more tailored to individual patients' level of risk. Patty Namond, NPR News.
There are over 1.5 million adopted children in this country under the age of 18, and the number grows by more than 100,000 every year. Now researchers have answered an important question about these kids. How is their emotional health? Reporter Michelle Trudeau has the story.
People have wondered for a long time whether children who were adopted in infancy are at increased risk for psychological problems. Now, in the first study of its kind, research psychologist Margaret Keyes actually tested the psychological well-being of adopted teenagers.
We assembled a sample of 692 adopted adolescents, all of whom had been adopted prior to 2 years of age.
In fact, the average child in this study went to live with their new family at only 4 months of age. When Keyes tested them, they were around 15 years old. They were given in-depth psychological interviews, checking for depression, anxiety, ADHD, and something called oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD.
These are kids who argue with their parents, who refuse to follow through on chores, maybe argue with their teachers, blame other people for their own mistakes.
More than just a negative teenager, ODD is persistent hostility and disobedience. For comparison, Keyes gave the same extensive psychological workup to a group of teenagers raised by their biological parents. The results are published this month in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine.
We found that most of the adolescents, adopted and non-adopted, were psychologically healthy. Overwhelmingly psychologically healthy.
That being said, Keyes did find what she calls an adoption effect.
There's a slightly increased risk for the adopted kids, especially ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder.
This risk was doubled in the adopted teenagers. Keyes explains.
So if you look at something like ADHD, for the non-adopted kids, about 7 out of every 100 had a diagnosis of ADHD. For the adopted kids, it's more like 14 or 15 out of every 100.
And similarly for oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, nearly a doubling of the risk. But there was no increased risk among adopted teenagers for depression or anxiety or for a form of serious delinquency that involves aggression, truancy, vandalism, and the like. David Brodzinski is professor emeritus from Rutgers University, a leader in the field of adoption research. He's not surprised that some psychological problems were doubled in a group of adopted children.
Many of the serious problems associated with adoption have less to do with adoption per se than with what happens before adoption.
Such as genetic factors, the health of the biological parents, possible exposure to alcohol or drugs in utero. All these before factors impact the later mental health of a child. Brodzinski's own research finds that adopting parents are a special breed, highly motivated, better educated, better off financially than non-adopting parents. And now Margaret Keyes adds to this list. Adopting parents were also more likely to get help from mental health professionals for their adopted child when behavioral problems arose. There's one more provocative finding from this study. Adopted children born in another country, most in this study came from South Korea, had slightly less ADHD than adopted children born in the United States. It's not clear why this may be the case. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
It seems like every time there's a big natural disaster, one or two news organizations will put out a report, erroneously, that corpses are spreading disease. As a health editor here at NPR, I'm usually called on to put out a memo saying what the facts are in a case like this. And when I put out the memo the other day, a producer for Weekend All Things Considered got interested and decided that they should talk to an expert about it. The host of that program, Andrea Seabrook, conducted the interview.
Dr. Claude Deville de Goye is a United Nations consultant and a veteran at directing disaster relief.
Dead bodies of healthy people do not spread disease. In fact, any infectious person is much more at risk when it is alive than when it's dead. You deal with bodies which are already decomposing. So the traditional human-to-human germs or microbes are not anymore present because they cannot survive in the condition of the bodies. What you have is decaying bacteria, which are not very dangerous.
Where does this idea then come from that dead bodies, a large amount of dead bodies in a disaster like this, spread disease?
It's very difficult to know because it seems to be really going back very much. I believe it may be from the European fear of the Great Plague, where really dead bodies were a source of flea contaminations and a source of plague.
Dr. Deville de Goye says that the fact that corpses do not cause disease doesn't mean they're not a concern.
You have logistical problems. It's not the public health problem, it's the logistical problems. So you have to have a burial but you have to do it showing some type of respect, not dumping dead bodies with carcass of animals or showing some respect. Because people need a grievance process. People need to feel respected. And this is shown by the way you treat dead bodies. In all cultures, some ritual, some respect is very much required. That's what makes the difference between human and animals.
Dr. Deville de Goye says more developed nations can afford to take greater care with corpses than less developed countries. In Thailand, after the tsunami 4 years ago, for instance, officials were able to fingerprint bodies and keep them refrigerated. The situation in Myanmar, he says, is likely to require mass burials.
That interview took place the day before the big earthquake in China. By coincidence, NPR had a team of journalists in the area of the earthquake. They've been providing some pretty compelling reports from there this week. You can hear them at NPR.org. And you can also read about other things they've been seeing and things that have been happening to the team at NPR.org/Chengdu Diary. Over the past few years, doctors and researchers and scientists of all stripes have come under fire for taking money from drug companies and other organizations that have a financial interest in the outcome of their research. The controversy has led some scientists to reject drug company money. One of those people is Peter Libby, the chief of cardiovascular medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. NPR's Madeline Brand, who's one of the hosts of the show Day to Day, talked to Dr. Libby about his decision.
Which companies were you accepting money from and for what?
Well, I work in cardiovascular prevention, and I would say that I've worked with virtually every company that has produced, manufactured, sold, or even thought about producing, manufacturing, or selling any product which could be used in cardiovascular prevention.
So you were very happy for a while to take money from these companies, and what happened? What changed?
What's changed really is the climate. I found that my credibility was really impaired by financial relationships with industry. And so I decided that my platform as a public spokesperson for cardiovascular prevention was more important than the personal remuneration. And so I decided to make a clean break.
Was there something specific that prompted you to make that break?
Well, you know, I worked on a public service documentary series that was aired by PBS. We aired this television series last October. And almost immediately, there were comments in the blogosphere that pointed out that certain of us who had been medical advisors had relationships with industry, and the integrity of the process and the program seemed to be impugned. This was a real wake-up call for me, because I realized no matter how much good you think you're doing and how much time and effort you put into a project which is meant for the public good, that you can be perceived as being biased because of relationships with industry.
You talk about being perceived as being biased. Do you think that you were, in fact, biased by taking money from industry, even if it was just unconsciously?
No, for a number of reasons. One is that I consult for so many companies that I'm not biased towards any particular product because I have been involved with virtually all of the marketed products. And secondly, I was never susceptible to pressure because I can walk away because I have my own research and clinical portfolio and never had to alter my message for anyone's agenda.
You know, a lot of your colleagues do admit that they are unconsciously affected by maybe not the money per se, but by the close relationship that they have with these companies. They actually like the people that they work with, and that it's a very tough thing to be able to tease out whether or not they are being influenced, even subtly, unconsciously, by these companies.
Well, in fact, when we're in consulting groups with the pharmaceutical industry, we're their severest critics. So, in fact, I think that one of the functions of the high-level consultants to industry is to help them with preserving the public good.
I guess a lot of this public criticism came about because a number of high-profile drugs have been called into question precisely because the doctors who worked on these trials were paid for in part by Big Pharma. Do do you think that it has swung too far in the other direction?
No, I think that the academic investigators need to be involved with pharma in order to assure the integrity of trials. And I think some of the lessons that we should learn is that there always should be an academic steering committee that is independent, that controls the trial, that owns the data of trials, even if they're fully sponsored by industry. And where I think we've run into rocky roads is where there have been shortcuts of this fundamental principle of assuring the integrity of trials.
Dr. Libby, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to share my thoughts with you.
That's Dr. Peter Libby. He's head of cardiovascular medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston.
If you want to hear more health stories, tune in to your local NPR station. There's a list of them at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, for more health and science stories, click on the Health and Science link over on the left side of the page. Joe Neal, NPR News.